From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Many of us experience the tension between being a good, loving, respectful child and the need to flee the home that created us. Working out that tension, understanding it, and coming to some kind of accommodation is the breakthrough to finding out who we really are. Eric Kim is a writer for the New York Times, where he contributes to the food section, New York Times Cooking, and the magazine. For him, food has been at the center of this journey. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Oh, that was a really beautiful intro. Thank you so much.
I was really struck reading your story, how it's universal, but not everybody works it out through food, and not everyone works it out directly with their parent.
Yeah, that's true. Tell me about it. You see why my dad's not in it that much. Just kidding. I love him.
The first time you ran away from home, where did you go and what did you begin to discover?
I ran away to my cousin Semi's house. She lives in Nashville still, and she was there cooking on the line, actually. She lived in this adorable house with a tiny, tiny stove. I remember it so clearly. It was like white and very small, narrow. And she had a Dutch oven. And so I got to cook in a Dutch oven for the first time. And I remember making coq au vin and just feeling so exhilarated at this idea that we were cooking as adults. I mean, I was only 17 at the time, but I realized that's really where this book started because it was so important to me in discovering the Korean part of my journey and the American parts as well.
So this primary tension for you between Koreanness and Americanness, how did you discover that you could use food to play with the space between to achieve a personal harmony?
Oh, man. I think it took maybe 2 years of not just writing the book, but also editing it. And it was a very painful but joyful process. I always talk about this book as a thing that really changed my family's life. When you get to see your story on the page made into a story that narrates the past, and the way things actually happen aren't that neat, and it takes the referring back to organize it into a story that makes sense. And that's a really healing process too. I would say it really started for me when I started writing about food. I wrote an essay about coming out to my mom, and she made us kimchi fried rice, and that was sort of this nexus point, and it kind of anchored the piece. And that was my first time trying out memoir in that way. And I felt after that first essay about kimchi fried rice, I wasn't able to get it all out of my system yet. So this book was sort of my way of just vomiting all over the page.
So last May, we spoke about your experience moving back home to Atlanta from New York to cook with your mom for this book.
Yeah.
And you've named a chapter in your book, The Tiger in the Hand. Can you speak about the experience of absorbing lessons, not all of them culinary?
Yeah, of course. I always describe my mom as a tiger. She's a tiger zodiac. She is a feisty person. She's kind of the voice of our family, very much a pack leader, I think. I was able to tell these stories about the kitchen because of the food that she was teaching me about. It was through the conversations I had with my mom sitting across from her at the kitchen island. She would cook in this way that was so just open. And what I mean by that is she taught me that in order to cook well, you have to be in the mood for it. I realized that she would just cook throughout the day as she had time and as she wanted to. And she would never cook when she didn't have to. And that worked out because there was all this food in the fridge that she had made previously. And while sitting across from her in that kitchen, I just heard stories she would tell me about when she was little in Korea and when she was a teenager, when she was in college. And these stories that just never came out, even out of her mouth, for years, because what food does is it helps you tap into old memories, not just any memories, but memories that you had forgotten you even had. And so I learned so much about my mother as a person, I think. And that was one of the biggest journeys of this book. And one reason why I really recommend people to stand by their parents' side and watch them cook and learn a recipe and interview them.
And I'm sure it was a life-changing experience for her as well.
Yeah.
She had to interact with you as an adult, and now she's seen this product that you created.
My mom's just someone who's she's very humble and she doesn't like attention. And so all this is very new to her and she's very casual about everything. And I was like, I wrote a book. It's kind of a big deal and hundreds of people are going to come to these events. She's like, oh yeah, I'm so proud of you. That's great. It wasn't until someone from church, that lady was like, hey, I read this great piece by Eric Kim in the New York Times. And my mom was like, that's my son. And then I think that's when she realized. She was like, oh, you're doing something here.
One of my favorite things about that particular essay and that chapter was how you managed to capture the language that she used to transmit what to look for in a dish. Nobody ever writes that stuff down.
Yeah. I think one really important thing that I had to get across was the cultural nuances of this cuisine. There's this word called 손맛. It translates to hand taste. And I think it's just the perfect way to explain this kind of cooking. And this kind of cooking exists across all cultures, but especially in Korean food, you're kind of using your hands to balance the taste, to balance the flavors. You're not really using measuring cups or spoons. So I think there's a lot of experience in the hands that is really hard to translate. And that was my job as a recipe developer, to try to approximate at least that flavor, which is mom taste, mom food. And the way she seasons her food, everything from that to like the little bottles of syrups and vinegars that she reaches for. And it took a lot of just watching her cook in an everyday kind of way for me to recognize that, wow, there's some magic here.
Would you mind just sharing with us a couple of the phrases she used?
She says 고소하다 a lot. And when she says that, it's referring to a really specific taste word, which refers actually to the flavor and the nuttiness of sesame oil and sesame seeds. I always joke that I'd like to pair up with a chemist and see if we can isolate 고소함 and that nuttiness that refers to that deep flavor of home that only sesame oil can provide.
Can you speak a bit about the role of sweetness in Korean food
and
the sweetener that your mom turns to that you tried to keep out of the book?
Sweetness is really important in Korean cuisine, and it's usually to do two things, which is to balance all the salty, spicy flavors and create this thing called danjan, which just means sweet, salty. And that flavor is just so, I say, tongue-latchingly good. It makes you do this. And I think my mom, there was a point in her life where she just kind of stopped using sugar for that, because sugar would normally be in these soy sauce braises and these sweetened gochujang, chicken dishes. But she reaches for maesilcheong, which is a green plum syrup. At first, I was trying to get her to stop using that because I wanted the recipes to be quote-unquote accessible. But as I wrote this book, I realized how political it actually all was to decide which ingredients to use in a pantry. And what I realized was that accessible to whom? So what I wanted to show was that if this amazing green plum syrup, which has such a fruity nuance, if that's so important to her cooking, then it has to be in the book.
Okay, I'd love to jump into some of the food. Let's start with a dish that is uniquely Southern, uniquely you, the gochugaru shrimp and roasted seaweed grits.
Oh, I know you'd say that. Man, that was one of the first recipes I developed when I moved back home, and my mom kept asking for it. What I loved about that dish was that it wasn't just shrimp and grits with Korean influences. Each part of it is a referent to another Korean thing. So the shrimp are marinated in lots of garlic, fish sauce, and gochugaru, which is this amazing Korean red pepper powder. Those are the flavorings you use for this fish stew called maeuntang. And then the grits, they are flavored in the way that I love my chuk, rice porridge. Other cultures call it kanji. It's that sesame oil. It's that 고소함, that nuttiness that's really hard to replicate. I like to crush in a whole packet of roasted seaweed snack, kim. Kim is just the flavor of my family. I realized while cooking that, wow, kim is something that we put in everything. And it makes sense. It has so much umami.
There's a photo of you and your mom making kimchi, which is so wonderful.
Thank you.
Tell us about her kimchi fridge.
My mom has about two or three kimchi fridges, and she has like a fridge in the basement and then another fridge in the garage. The second fridge for a lot of people is a place to create a pantry of your own. And my mom's quote-unquote pantry involves all kinds of kimchis. The book only covers her napa cabbage kimchi, and she has a lot of radish kimchis, and she has burdock root kimchi and mustard green kimchi that's like really incredible. A lot of these more nuanced bitter kimchis that just make my mouth water because they are so wonderful.
I would love if you would share with us the dish that most represents you right now from the book.
Oh, man. You know, I'm in this weird like nostalgia beat. So the dish that really means a lot to me in terms of that is the maple milk bread. That milk bread, it sort of stops time for me because it takes so long for the bread to proof. I like that because you have decided to spend this time. That milk bread, I just really encourage people to make it because there isn't more of a Korean-American story in my mind. It's a replication of the loaves that we would find on Buford Highway. And this woman named Sung Hee Kim, she started this chain of Korean bakeries in Atlanta called White Windmill. Whenever I make that bread, I'm taken back to Atlanta, taken back to the past. There's a lot of stories in the past. They become real resonances once you tie them to the present. And that's what I'm doing right now, I think, with my work.
Thank you so much, Eric. It was so much fun talking to you.
So fun. Always great. Thank you.
That was Eric Kim, a food and cooking writer for the New York Times. His new book is Korean American, Food That Tastes Like Home. One of his recipes, you can visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, those gorgeous vintage paintings of fruit have a fascinating and underappreciated history.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. You've probably seen vintage paintings of fruit in all their botanical detail in thrift stores and poster shops. Beyond their beauty, many of these illustrations are so accurate that they are still used today to identify and examine varieties decades after they were drawn. In fact, the USDA has more than 7,500 of these paintings. They've been collected in an extraordinary 356-page book, an illustrated catalog of American fruits and nuts. Adam Leith Goldner's introduction fronts the new illustrated catalog of the collection. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
This is such a particular and special book. Why do these drawings exist?
These paintings exist because they were scientific and documentary images in a time before we really had color photography or DNA testing or other means of identifying fruits. The paintings were the main way that our pomologists were able to ID fruits.
I always think of these paintings as being the food cousin to the Audubon bird paintings.
Oh, yeah. That's a great comparison. Both of them are the sorts of images that we just want to look at. And there's something about the colors. In the case of these fruit paintings, I always thought of them as vitamins for our eyes in the way that fruits are good for us, but these paintings are also good for the spirit.
That's so true. And also for me, it's just so moving to realize the commitment of the people who did these to document what they were seeing.
Yeah, it was a big undertaking, and it lasted for decades, from the late 1880s until the early 1940s. Thousands upon thousands of these paintings and drawings were produced and were commissioned by the USDA's Division of Pomology, and they still have an important scientific role, but to people like you and I think their primary role is aesthetic, but they were and remain scientifically important and useful.
Who made them? Was it a huge number of artists doing this work, or did a few artists have huge output?
It was a total of around 20 painters were kind of responsible for most of it. And 50% of the artworks were done by just three women. So women played a really crucial role in the program.
Can you describe the culture of the day that plays into a fascination around fruit?
If we go back to the late 1800s, life was very different then, and most people lived in rural areas. Growing fruit was central to most people's livelihoods. They had them in their backyards, they had them on the farms. Growing fruit was just something that everybody did. The vast majority of people had crops that they grew, and fruits were among those. There was also a lot of enthusiasm for the potential around fruit. We didn't really know exactly what the possibilities were. Today, we live in a world where we all have blueberries, for example, at the supermarket year-round from all over the world. Blueberries are a $4.5 billion industry. But in the late 19th century, blueberries weren't even domesticated yet. They weren't a thing that we knew how to grow. The same applied with many other types of fruits. So the whole idea of creating a division of pomology was because fruit groves and orchards were seen as crucial to American prosperity.
So the blueberry story is really interesting, also because it was a woman, Elizabeth White, who had a role in creating a domesticated blueberry. Could you talk a bit about that and about her?
Elizabeth White is today known as the Blueberry Queen. She had received this pamphlet in, I think it was 1910. There was a kind of bulletin that went out called Experiments in Blueberry Culture. At the time, the blueberry was what they called strangely overlooked because they knew it was sweet. We've all had those little wild, tart little blueberries, but the domesticated blueberry was just a dream. They were doing experiments. They were trying to figure out how to grow it. And you have Elizabeth White, who lived in the Pine Barrens and felt that there was a real potential to have a crop that could be immensely successful. And she was right. And so as part of their experiments, paintings were made of some of the successful specimens that they managed to discover or create. What's kind of interesting about it is that they also came across some blueberries that weren't maybe exactly what they were looking for, whether they had aluminum-colored exteriors, like metallic exterior, or whether they were white or red blueberries. And all of this came back into importance recently because there's a new type of blueberry that's entering the world marketplace called the pink blueberry. One of the famous varieties of it is called the pink lemonade blueberry. And when the USDA was working on developing this pink lemonade blueberry, the testers who were doing their own experiments with it consulted these original paintings that Elizabeth White and the USDA scientists had made when they were doing their experiments. Today, we haven't heard of pink blueberries, but I don't know, maybe in 120 years, pink blueberries will be so common that they'll say, can you imagine a time when there were no pink blueberries in supermarkets?
Are images of these fruits that are documented backed up with seed in a vault somewhere?
Yes. The USDA has all these germplasm repositories, and not just the United States, but most countries around the world have their crops backed up in seed vaults. In Geneva, New York, for example, you have the apple collection of the USDA. And in California, you could have a citrus collection, which is, I believe, in Riverside. When you go to these facilities and you walk through the trees, you really get a sense of how vast the biodiversity of a certain species is.
The last time you were on the show, it was on the occasion of a book that you wrote about fruit hunters, which existed within this time period. Explorers who went out to find fruit. Can you give us a taste of what fruit hunting is like, perhaps by sharing your experience of tasting grapes in Georgia and Armenia?
Oh, yeah, what a memory. And especially today, when we think of what's going on in Ukraine, it's kind of emotional to think about how vulnerable some of these areas are. The wild center of origin for grapes is in the Transcaucasus, somewhere around Georgia or Armenia. And I went to this center for grapevine planting material in a little village called Saguramo. It's got hundreds of varieties of indigenous grapes. And I happened to be there in autumn when it was grape season. They said, yeah, just go walk through the collection. And every plant was a different variety of grape. You taste all these different grapes that have different colors and sizes and flavors. And some of them are sweet and some of them were bitter and some of them tasted like olives.
What I find looking at this collection of paintings, or at least the ones that are represented in the book, is you can get a sense of how a person could become obsessed.
I love hearing that. It's true. You just look at the grape paintings in here, for example, and I really feel like looking at the paintings is also the equivalent of walking through those rows of grapevines and tasting those grapes. These paintings are activating our imaginations, and they have this, I don't know what it is, like it really kind of transporting effect on us.
Me too. And I think part of it is how different they are from photography.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. In a way, these are examples of modernist art, and they have a deeper potency than a photograph.
I want to thank you so much, Adam. This has been such fun.
Well, it's been a lot of fun for me as well.
That was pomologist Adam Leith-Golner talking about the gorgeous book he helped compile, An Illustrated Catalog of American Fruits and Nuts. To see a few of these stunning illustrations, visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Hot cross buns, leg of lamb, shelled peas, and glazed ham. These are all Easter traditions in the United States, where 2.3 million Christians observe the holiday. Other countries have their own Easter traditions. In Mexico, capirotada is a popular one. Here to tell us more about this sweet dish served in Mexican Catholic homes during Lent is author and cook Rick Martinez. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
It's great to have you on. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So talk about capirotada for us. Did you have it growing up? Did you like it?
I have to admit something. I was not a huge fan of it. I think it was the way that it was prepared. So I grew up in Austin, Texas, and what was very common in Austin at that time during the 70s, and actually, frankly, even now, is regular sandwich bread would be used. It was toasted and then layered with dried or fresh apples, raisins, nuts, and then soaked with a piloncillo or a brown sugar sauce with syrup with cinnamon and sometimes cloves, and then topped with sliced American cheese and then baked. It wasn't appetizing. American cheese and sliced white bread, just not very interesting. And it wasn't until I started traveling around Mexico researching my cookbook that I discovered that capirotada here is very, very different than what I was used to in Central Texas.
It's so interesting how things change when they move.
Completely. I think it speaks to the regionality. There in Austin in that time period, that was what was accepted and readily available and probably economical and therefore used. Here, it's very different. You have panaderias that are, you know, ubiquitous, and bolillos, a French-style roll, and other Mexican sweetbreads are very common, very easily accessible, economical. And so those are the breads that are used, and they are better quality than sliced American white bread.
I would love to hear some of the variations that you found when you were traveling in Mexico.
It's all based on region and what's available locally. And so the further south you go, the more tropical the country gets. And so you have papayas and pineapple and mangoes growing in those regions. But you also, because of demand in the U.S. during the colder months, you also have a lot of berries, a lot of raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries. The fruit and the nuts and sometimes seeds are very locally dependent. But what I found were the constants were the bread, which was either a bolillo, which is the Mexican French-style roll, or conchas or pan dulces, which is sort of like a brioche-style roll with a slightly sweet, sugary topping. And a lot of times those rolls are brightly colored, pink, yellow, sometimes chocolate, sometimes vanilla. And then the syrup, I thought, was another constant. The syrup is piloncillo, which is essentially Mexican brown sugar. So in the sugar refining process, all of the things that are left, which is the really dark, almost smoky, very deeply caramelized sugarcane, is then packaged, and it has just an incredibly robust flavor, not quite as strong as a molasses, but definitely, I think, more caramelly and more complex than an American brown sugar. So you make the syrup with the piloncillo and cloves and cinnamon and allspice, and then you basically bathe that in your bread and your nuts, your seeds, your fruits, and then bake that. The top is studded with cheese. It can be queso fresco. It might be a queso menonita or queso chihuahua, which is similar to a Monterey Jack. Generally, the cheese layer is on top, and that actually carries a lot of religious symbolism as well.
What is that symbolism?
This is a Lenten dessert or breakfast, and the entire dish, all of the components of it, have a very strong religious symbolic meaning. And so the bread represents the body of Christ. The syrup represents the blood of Christ. The cinnamon or the canela represents the cross. The cloves represent the nails that were used. The cheese represents the shroud. So it's very much steeped in Catholicism.
Is the only bath that a traditional capirotada get is the syrup?
I would say in the southern half of the country, that is true. I didn't know until I started traveling around the northern part of the country that there is another version, capirotada blanca or capirotada de leche. In the northern part of the country, there are a lot of dairy farms. And so in those northern areas, there is this version that instead of having the piloncillo syrup, a milk-based syrup similar to what is used for tres leches is made and then used.
I would love it if you would walk us through your process of the kind that you make.
I prefer the capirotada de leche or blanca. I either get conchas or another sweet brioche-style bread and then just break them up and tear them up into bits. And then I create that mixture of sweetened condensed milk, heavy cream, and evaporated milk. And I do steep that milk combination with the cinnamon and the cloves. When I went to the market, I actually found some really beautiful dried peaches. And so I ended up using that with some toasted almonds. And I just really loved all of that flavor combination. I think that Americans typically think that there is a way to make or an authentic version of every dish, when in reality, depending on where you live and your own personal sazon, your preferences, your flair in the kitchen, you will create a dish that you like that is very personal to you.
Did you forgo the cheese?
No, I actually used the queso fresco, which I like. What I found is either cotija, which has a little bit of a sharper edge to it, or the farmer's cheese. To me, it just added to the richness of the dairy without giving a long-aged or sharp flavor.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really look forward to speaking to you again soon when your upcoming cookbook, Mi Cocina, hits the stands.
Thank you. I would love to talk to you again as well.
Will we find a recipe for capirotada in your cookbook?
Not in the cookbook. I actually decided to stay away from desserts, but I do have a capirotada recipe in video, and I will send you the link to that.
Thank you so much. That was Rick Martinez. We've been discussing the Mexican Lenten bread pudding, capirotada. Look for Rick's cookbook, Mi Cocina, this May. In a minute, how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has impacted the global food chain. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. In this interconnected world, circumstances in one country can impact people all around the globe. Food prices were already going up thanks to the pandemic, among other reasons. Then came the war in Ukraine. Siobhan McDonough is a reporter at Vox. She wrote about how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shaken the global food chain. Hi, Siobhan.
Hi. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
Let's start with the most recent news. Just this week, the UN food chief warned that the war in Ukraine was threatening to devastate the World Food Program and said that the impact would be beyond, quote, anything we've seen since World War II, unquote. What did he mean by that? And what is the World Food Program?
So the World Food Program is a UN agency that provides food support to people around the world facing hunger and food insecurity. And they do this through directly procuring food, such as wheat, for these people, but also providing cash grants for food. So, for example, if the price of food is going up, the World Food Program will provide cash grants so people can meet their basic needs. Basically, what's been happening, even before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the price of food globally was at highs that we haven't seen since 2011. And that's been driven by various factors, droughts, overly heavily rainfall, as well as broader supply chain disruptions created by COVID-19 and rising fuel prices. And this was before the invasion in Ukraine. So it was estimated that the WFP was incurring $42 million more per month for food purchases prior to the Ukraine crisis because of the already high food and fuel prices globally. And since the invasion, they've started incurring another $29 million more per month. You know, that's $71 million globally more each month because of the higher food and fuel prices.
We should say that the World Food Program feeds roughly 125 million people around the globe.
And that is of 855 million people already suffering from food insecurity. So food insecurity, this is people not necessarily at the risk of starvation, but it means people who can't get food at all times in sufficient quantity and quality.
Russia and Ukraine both have often been called Europe's breadbasket. Why is that? And what are these two countries' biggest commodities?
Russia and Ukraine provide roughly 26% of global wheat exports in 2020. Wheat is their biggest export as part of the global food supply, but they also provide a lot of sunflower seed, oil, barley, corn, fertilizers, and other exports. The price of energy also, everyone knows about rising gas prices, I'm sure, is also a huge contributor to global food prices. And what's interesting is that Russia and Ukraine may be Europe's breadbasket, but most of the places that they export to are actually outside of Europe. So the top importers of wheat from Russia and Ukraine are actually mostly in the Middle East, North Africa region, such as Egypt, Turkey, Yemen, and also in Southeast Asia. So the disruption to these supply chains and these exports are hitting these countries that have already a high number of food insecure people in them the hardest.
You know, when I hear that, for example, Egypt is a huge importer of wheat from Ukraine and Russia, I think back to the food riots that sort of precipitated the spring revolution in that part of the world. And one wonders what's going to happen to countries whose populations are already being pushed to the brink in terms of food.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in a worst case scenario, this disruption to commodity prices could contribute to conflict in areas of the world that are not directly affected by the original event. Hopefully that does not become the case, but that is a possibility. And that's something that we've found. I've been focusing on Lebanon, and it's not only this food disruption caused by the war in Ukraine. It's also different conditions within country that are contributing to this. So if there's already economic stability, if there's already rising food prices, lower government subsidies, more limited purchasing power due to inflation, those things can all contribute to instability. And the Ukraine crisis is just adding to that.
Do you think that people who aren't direct importers of wheat from that region will also feel the effects, like here in the United States, for example?
I do think that's possible. The United States actually is a producer of wheat, but countries that are importing food, the effects will be felt through fuel prices. Most of the cost consumers pay is after a commodity leaves the farm. So only about one quarter of that commodity price is on the farm. Three quarters is post farm gate. So that's processing, that's manufacturing, that's transportation. And that all consumes a lot of energy. So as energy prices rise due to these disruptions, that will affect global food prices.
What alternative deals are countries trying to make to get the wheat they need?
So I think the good news here is that there is enough wheat to go around, and that about 30 to 31 of the world's wheat stocks are in reserve, which is up from even a few years ago. So that means countries can get wheat from the US, for example, from Australia, from other countries in Europe, from Argentina. So there is enough wheat to go around. It just means that transportation costs might be higher from these places. It also means that prices will be higher in general. And that's where aid will be needed, at least in the short and medium term.
If the situation stabilizes soon, which we all desperately hope will happen, how long do you think it will take for prices to return to normal?
I think that depends on a lot of factors. So it depends on both how quickly exports are able to come back, whether the Ukrainian planting season has been disrupted, what gas and energy prices are looking like across the globe. And then also all of these other things that are contributing to a rise in global food prices. So for example, there's still these after effects of COVID-19, the pandemic, and there's still climate change. And so it's really hard to predict because this is one factor among many.
Thank you so much, Siobhan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was reporter Siobhan McDonough of Vox. Want to read her story about how the war in Ukraine is impacting the global food chain? You'll find a link on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Hasn't wanted to escape from reality these last few years, even just for the brief spell of a meal. Yuko Watanabe has two spaces in Los Angeles that are living green oases for the beleaguered eater looking for Japanese comfort food. She talks to us this week for In the Weeds.
My name is Yuko Watanabe. I'm the owner of Yuko Kitchen. I have two locations. One is Miracle Mile. One is in downtown location. I started this business about 14 years ago, just by myself and one dishwasher guy. And now it's really becoming popular, and I have more than 30 employees and having really good time every day working with them. And I have hundreds of customers every day. I've been always a big fan of cooking, and growing up in Japan, where my mom always cooked, she used to bake cookie for next day's snack. So watching her baking made me start wanting to work at the bakery in Japan, and that's where I got all the pastry skill. And moved to LA, I wanted to pursue pastry career, but nobody hired me. And they say, here in the US, we don't pay much money or attention to the cookies or pastries. They don't pay expensive money for that. So why don't you go to sushi bar to get a job? They will pay you more. And so I did. I started working at the sushi bar as a waitress, but then the same day I started working there, sushi chef quit. So the owner of the restaurant said, hey, why don't you start cooking with us? And I will teach you one by one. I knew a little bit of background of how to cut the fish from my home. So it was shortcut and much easier than just for anybody. So I start making sushi in a few months later, and then as a professional female sushi chef, and that's how I started it. I think I worked probably 7 years as a sushi chef, and I always have a big heart of baking as well. And when I was ready, I started my catering company, because as I was sushi chef, a lot of customers asked, like, hey, why don't you come up to our party and cook for us as a sushi chef? We are having party. So how I started was Yuko Kitchen, which wasn't restaurant first. It was just a little apartment kitchen that I started. That's why it's called Yuko Kitchen. And I saved enough money from the catering Yuko Kitchen to open restaurant, and I never really wanted to open big expensive restaurant to begin with, and I always wanted to open something you can come really casually and relax your time, food and pastry, that's my passion, and relax. That's how I started Yuko Kitchen in the Miracle Mile. I used to serve huge cake and rice bowl and salad, and I noticed not everybody wants to buy huge cake after the meal because they're always full from my food. My food is always big, huge portion, and nobody has enough room to enjoy my big pastry. So I start baking a lot of cookies, which is like good size to after the lunch, after the dinner size. And that's how I start baking chocolate chip cookie, brownies, and blondie. And it became really popular. And then I start inventing more stuff, like, why don't I put green tea in it? Why don't I put a lot of strawberry that I have left over with? And I start inventing a lot of unique recipe from my own ideas. And seems like people start liking this a lot. Here I am. I have a restaurant with probably 20 kinds of cookies to go with, and a lot of drinks that I always like, mint lemonade, which is slushy mint. I grew up in the countryside where lots of mountains and nature around. So living in a city, I miss those. And I start decorating the restaurant with a lot of plants. And then all the plants start growing around the restaurant. And then before I knew, it became jungle. So that's the that's the first 10 years, I guess. So Japanese comfort food, I will say, it's like your mom cooks after the school kind of meal. Mostly like how I eat at home. But Japanese traditional restaurant food is a little different. It's like comes in a little tiny individual dishes. There's a rice bowl, there's a soup bowl, there's a main dish with the fish, and then there's another little dish with the pickle, and there's another little dish, and so on and so on. But instead, my dishes are just one big dish. That's what I call Japanese comfort food. After 10 years, I worked so hard and then I got nothing to do. What should I do? Then I start looking for the other location, which I found in a downtown. This building used to be a dance studio with a 16-foot ceiling with huge fan. It's a beautiful spot. I just immediately fall in love with it. It took literally 2 years to make it happen, but it was totally worth it. It's like a sitting in a greenhouse. Why not I put more plants to begin with and take the advantage of the sunshine? So I start hanging all the plants from the ceiling and put more plants on the tables, and people start noticing, and eventually they start asking me, would you like to sell them because they look beautiful? I was like, okay, why not? I start putting more plants, because I just love them. And I think they produce better air, I guess. During the pandemic, it's so sad because nobody could come. And one day I was like, I'm not gonna put the chair upside down. Instead, I'm gonna put the plants. So I start going to nursery more often and buy plants as much as I want. That's like my therapy. The people start noticing, like, hey, why don't you sell them? And then, okay, why not? And before I knew, my restaurant became jungle. Now it's like out of control. It's like plants are everywhere. But during the pandemic, we pretty much survived because of the plant sale and to-go food. That was very special days, those 2 years of a pandemic. We actually made a little community. A lot of people start noticing because walking in a downtown between the concrete walls, and suddenly this bright, airy restaurant show up. What is this? And they come in and everybody's like, wow, what is this? Like, we never knew you guys exist in the middle of the concrete city. So in Japan, people say over 30 is like the Christmas cake after the Christmas. They're half price off. I'm right now 44 years old. So if it's true, I had been in a freezer for a long time. But I will say that's very boring. I'm not ordinary Christmas cake to begin with. I was more than the Christmas cake. I happened to choose very unordinary life, coming to here, US by myself. And I just didn't really have time to think about, oh, I should find a boyfriend now and get married and have a baby. I was like, oh my gosh, I forgot. I just kind of forgot doing that. And then I don't really have the urge to do. Not everybody is wanting to do the same pattern. I don't think it's wrong to do something what I love and something what I enjoy, truly enjoy to do in my life. So yeah, that's my life, I guess. Very basic one at my restaurant is teriyaki chicken rice bowl. It comes with rice, salad, it's half-half, and then on top of the rice, there's like a very tender teriyaki chicken on it. It's caramelized with the soy sauce and then the special teriyaki sauce from my recipe. And then the salad, it's a carrot dressing, it's tangy, it's sweet. So overall, everything is in a one rice bowl, and you can taste sweet, salty, savory, and comfort. And then I also have this special plate. It comes with either chicken or beef or tofu or fish. It's like a happy meal for adults because it comes in a one plate, has rice and your choice of protein, salad, shot of today's soup, 4 pieces of sushi, and even comes with mini dessert, which is assorted my cookie and whipped cream. You feel comfortable, you feel full, and then you feel happy after the meal.
That was Yuko Watanabe, owner of Yuko Kitchen in Miracle Mile, and Yuko Kitchen downtown, as well as Yuko Curry. Visit her website, yukokitchen.com, for menus, location, and hours. Up next, maybe you've heard of watermelon radishes, but have you ever heard of honeydew radishes? I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims for the Market Report. We're here today at the Hollywood Farmers Market. I'm here with Sarah Kramer, co-chef and owner of Kismet Restaurant in East Hollywood. Good morning, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's so nice to see you.
So we're here at the Hollywood Market, and I saw that you took a tour by Weiser Family Farm stand to look at what they have. What were you looking for today, and what did you see?
Well, I have been obsessed with their radishes for like probably 2 months now. They have them for a long time, but right now in particular, we're using this honeydew radish. It's a green radish, which I feel like really catches you off guard in terms of it being like sweet and delicious, but it's so good.
Tell me about the first time you had the honeydew radish and what kind of drew you in about its flavor and texture and everything.
For some reason this year, they just really jumped out at me. They're number one, so beautiful. So you can't really not think about that when you're having it. You're just like, wow, this beautiful kind of like light green, ethereal, kind of elfy looking radish. And then you try it and it's really sweet and really crisp. And the texture is actually really meaty and dense. Also, they hold up really well when they're shaved. They're also really nice for crudité. They have a great texture. I don't know. They do it all.
How would you say they compare to like a regular red breakfast rice that people can find at the grocery stores?
I think that they have more complex flavor. They're like nuttier and sweeter, and they have, I think, only a light spiciness. They're not very spicy, in my opinion, which is nice. Granted, radishes always vary. Like sometimes you can have a red radish that tastes like nothing, just like tastes like crunchy water, and sometimes you can have one that's really, really spicy. So you just have to try them all to make sure that they're what you're looking for. But for some reason, the ones at Weiser, he's a magician, they're always good.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people sometimes don't like radishes because they might think they're a little too spicy, but then these seem like they're like a little milder and have a lot more going on. Would you say that?
Yeah, if you don't like radishes, this radish will prove you wrong.
So now that you have the honeydew radishes, what are you planning to do with them at Kismet?
So what we already do with them at Kismet is shave them thinly and put them on top of a crudo. It's really clean and the radishes give really nice texture. They're a great contrast with the fish. And it's a nice summery dish for this summery weather that we have.
What type of fish is in the crudo and what are the other flavors kind of going on in the dish that complement the radishes?
It is a striped bass crudo and it gets dressed with some hoja santa. Hoja santa is like a big sort of licorice-y leaf. It's, I believe, originally of Mexican origin. It's delicious. You may have had it like pressed into a tortilla at some point, but we puree it and use it as like kind of a vinaigrette sort of to dress the fish with, and it's really, really tasty. It's a nice sort of sweet, like anisey contrast to the crispness of the radish.
For, you know, for anyone at home who, like, they want to get these radishes and try them out, what are some other ways that you think would be good to try them and to utilize their textures and flavors and everything?
Well, they're great, like I said before, as a crudité, so you can, like, dip them in anything, whether you shave them thinly or cut them into wedges. I also personally really like roasting radishes also. So if you haven't tried cooking your radishes, highly recommend. I love a grilled radish. Yeah, there's a lot of options out there for radishes.
I don't think a lot of people cook their radishes. So like what, like a simple roasted radish, can you explain that?
Yeah, I think it's like as easy as coating it in olive oil and salt and roasting it in a hot oven. They're really nice when they have some caramelization on the outside and then they're kind of soft and watery through the middle, which for me is a great texture. I really like it and it would be really nice alongside a roast chicken or a roast piece of fish.
Wow, that sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Sarah.
So happy to be here.
That was Sarah Kramer, co-chef and owner of Kismet and Kismet Rotisserie in Los Feliz. I'm here with Michelle Weiser from Weiser Family Farms. Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks.
We're here today. We just spoke with Sarah Kramer of Kismet Restaurant, who's using your honeydew radishes in a dish there at the restaurant. And so I wanted to talk to you about all the radishes that you guys sell at Weiser Family Farms, and particularly the honeydew radish. Tell me about that radish and like how it got its name and everything that you know about it.
Yeah, so it's a daikon variety type radish, and so it's like a longer, instead of your traditional round radish. It is white on the bottom and green towards the top. So it's milder on the bottom and then gets a little spicier at the end. And it's like, it's very crunchy. Yeah, it's really delicious. Really great for pickling too.
So I know that, like, you know, the small breakfast radishes that people get at the store grow pretty quickly. Is it the same for these radishes? Or are they like a little bit longer? And like what's the size in comparison as well?
Yeah, they're, well, traditionally, if you're going to, like, pickle, you'd go with, like, a bigger radish. So you keep, we just keep them in the ground longer. But a lot of people like them really small for pickling or just, like, munching on. So generally, like, a smaller radish is going to be a little hotter just because it's not quite developed, like, its flavor. It's a little spicier. So even, like, a milder radish, if you picked it small, it'd just be, like, a little spicy. But as they get a little bigger, they're better. Well, they're not better, but they have more of their, like, natural flavor. Like, they, you know, and then, so it's not quite as spicy. You can taste, like, the differences between the radishes. I like to go, like, medium. Like, I'm not, unless I'm pickling, I try to go, like, a medium size.
Can you describe, like, because I know she talked about the honeydew radishes, the artesia. Can you describe the differences in flavor between the radishes?
Yeah. So the honeydew radish is super, is like a little spicy, like I said. We have black radishes too, and those are very spicy, almost like horseradish. And they're black on the outside and like super white inside. They're pretty cool looking like on a plate, and they'll clean out your sinuses a little bit, which is fun. But then we also have the artesia, which are very pink inside. They dye your hands a little bit like a beet, but they're very mild, and they're kind of my favorite right now. Like I fluctuate, but that's the ones I'm gravitating to right now. Also, we have the purple ninja radish, which is purple on the outside. And when you cut it open, it has like, it's white, but with like a burst of purple. So it's like gorgeous on a plate. It's just a tiny bit spicy, but it's really nice. Really great on a salad, really great on tacos. Like just very versatile.
Wow, that sounds delicious. Do you like to cook with the radishes at home? And if so, like what things do you make with them? How do you like to enjoy them?
Yeah, I mean, I generally like them raw, but I do like cut them really thin. I squeeze lemon on them and do a coarse salt just like for a nice snack. But they're great and dipped in hummus. I know everybody, that's like a great treat, right? Sliced thinly on top of tacos is super great, but you can also roast them. I think people forget that a lot with other root vegetables is pretty good. Also like the French, you know, in a sandwich with just butter, it's really easy to do and super yummy. Mm-hmm.
That sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
That was Michelle Weiser of Weiser Family Farms in Tehachapi, California. For the Market Report, this has been Mims.
Missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, and Nick Lamponi. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. My mom wasn't a great cook, but I still make her garlicky Parmesan salad dressing that was known at Angeli as forte dressing every day. It's possible that it can be traced back to Tex on Sunset. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.